Hey everyone, I'm Jay, and I'm joined here today by Sen and special guest Al.
Hey everyone.
And today's episode is called The Personal is Political. This one's going to be a little more philosophical, a little more political, so it might be more difficult to follow if you're not familiar with these terms, but we would encourage you to
look things up.
Yeah, look things up. As much as we would like to provide this information, I think it's really important to educate yourself.
You have Google.
We might drop some resources from Pro Asian Voice in the description that might help. But basically, we're going to talk about the state of Asian diaspora, our consciousness, a lot of foundational issues that we're seeing, and how we want to remedy those things. So, to begin, there are some pretty alarming stats about Asian Americans and personal beliefs about racism. Studies have shown that 61% of Asian Americans believe that racial discrimination against us exists, but a whopping 68% actually believe that it is due to individual prejudice rather than...
And not systemic.
Yeah, it's not systemic. They don't think it's about laws or government policy, which is obviously ahistorical because there is a long and sordid history of institutionalized systemic oppression. What the fuck? As a community, we basically don't believe we face institutional racism.
Yeah, it's just a coincidence that it keeps happening.
Well, why is this? How can we fix that?
Well, I think I can start from an American perspective, right? So in the late 60s, early 70s, you had what was known as the Yellow Power Movement or the Asian American Movement. And there was three pillars to this movement, right? The first one was talking about basically class-based politics, right? So like wages, working conditions, poverty, bamboo ceiling, those are all considered class-based politics. And then the second plank is around homeland politics. And homeland politics can relate to raising the international standing of your homeland. So that can be things like the K-pop wave, you know, the rise of Korea and Japan and the tiger economies, all those kinds of things. And then also fighting to free our homelands from colonial or neo-colonial rule, right? Like in South Korea and in Japan. And the final leg of it was assimilationist politics. And I'm not using assimilationist as a pejorative here, although very often, you know, it can be pretty damning, but that's about gaining the full rights and privileges due to one by right of citizenship to the United States of America. All right, so you had those three legs of a political movement known as Yellow Power. It was grounded in leftist ideology because that was the counterculture at the time, or the counter-hegemonic narrative. But, you know, as we had military adventurism in Asia, right, starting from Indochina and moving forward, what ended up happening is you created like these waves of basically new immigrants and refugees, especially after the 1965 Hart-Celler Act opened up America for immigration. It lifted all those quotas. And the ones that came over here, by virtue of one reason or another, right, they all had strong hyper-individualistic right-wing sympathies or ideologies, right? So they could be straight up the losing side in the wars of imperialist aggression, white supremacist imperialist aggression that America conducted all throughout Asia throughout the last 100 years. Or they could be collaborators, right? Like we talk about how in Latin America, the Creoles were collaborators, right, with the Peninsulares. In Asia, you had that too. You had compradors in China that were like merchants. And in South Korea, you had like Chinilpa. We call them national traitors. Like, they were collaborators under Imperial Japan, and then US installed them back in power in order to establish South Korea. So then you might have like people like the first president of the Republic of Korea, of South Korea, Syngman Rhee, who actually went to Harvard here in the United States, right? You had these collaborators that were coming over here, traitors. Basically like all the wartime refugees that were fleeing, right? Like the terror that was being caused by US intervention in their homeland countries. So they came over here and they had a very different conception or different perspective or ideology than like the previous yellow power movement. You know, the people in the Asian American movement, they latched onto assimilationist politics, but it was overlaid with a veneer of respectability politics, like deep, deep respectability politics, you know? And there's always been a strong streak of that in the Asian American community. And that's going dating all the way back to the Japanese American, what is it, the JACL, all the civil American organizations for
Chinese Americans.
There was always a strong assimilationist streak and respectability streak there anyways. And that just got amplified and accelerated by all the new waves of immigrants that came over. And like, that was a real transformation and shift, you know, the modern Asian American diaspora, Asian diaspora, at least in America, all the Five Eyes countries, including Australia. That's a recent arrival, and it fundamentally transformed, you know, the history of Asians in America, right? Like, so we went from like 3 million in 1980 to like 11 million or so by 2000, and we're at 20 million now. And all those waves of immigrants, right, were all this right wing, you know, hyper individualistic, hyper competitive, trying to assimilate into the existing power structure, like that type of mentality, very subservient, not wanting to cause trouble, all that kind of jazz.
Yeah, it was definitely very self-selecting. And I've thought about this before.
Yeah, very self-selecting.
That the type of people who would come here would already be sympathetic to the American way, in the sense of that hyper-competitive, super exploitative capitalist kind of mindset. So it's really difficult to build unity among a group of people who fundamentally don't feel like they belong to a group or have that kind of identity.
They don't have any form of group identity, which is why, you know, you see all this angst over what it means to be Asian American, when really that's like the easiest one. Like, that's the easiest question. You know, you're formed as a reaction to white racism.
Yes, right? It's like, political.
Yeah. Erica Lee, in her Making of Asian America, she actually says that, you know, like, the only thing truly uniting the Asian diaspora in the West is our common experience of systematic white racism. So like, the very identity of being an Asian in one of these Western countries, especially these Anglo-majority countries, embedded in the concept of being Asian is in opposition to white people. You understand that? Because they put themselves in opposition to you. Like, the identity of whiteness is an empty concept. It's hollow, right? It has no significant meaning. It's an oppositional identity. It's an adversarial identity to all other identities that are considered non-white.
There's a lot of people who mistakenly believe that racism is an individual thing that arises naturally. But in the context of whiteness and white supremacy, it was created as a tool to dehumanize people in order to better exploit. So obviously, when you look at it that way, of course, it is fundamentally oppositional to everything non-white.
And so, like, what does it mean to be an Asian American? Well, then, you know, then you're in opposition, right? You didn't make yourself the opposition. They made themselves the opposition. So it is what it is. The teams have been decided, you see? Like, that's the easiest part. The hard part is getting people to understand that we're all on the same team, and that the other team is actually the other team. That's not your team. That's the enemy. It's difficult, I think, for Asians in Western diaspora countries to truly grasp this, even though it gets proved over and over again. And I think a lot of it is due to the fact that, you know, we have high levels of political apathy, where we withdraw into our private and our personal lives and don't really pay attention to like the world that we're embedded in. You know, we create these little pockets where we're living in this sort of bubble, you know, both physically, a lot of times, you know, whether you're withdrawn into an apartment complex or living in an enclave, but also psychologically, you've withdrawn yourself from public life. You only interact with like public life through mannequins, through figures, you know, through like brief encounters with, you know, people that don't even seem like people to you. You know, you're not really engaged with the world. You've withdrawn, right? And you've withdrawn into all your private spaces, the areas you go, like, you know, all your little nooks and crannies, the little habitual places that you visit, all right? And that's your private little world. And you don't take any interest and you don't get engaged in the wider world around you. And that's the difference between public and private, right? It can look very different. Your private sphere can also look very different depending on how much money you have.
Yeah.
I can definitely relate, because I know a lot of people my age who have regressed into living kind of just in their room and not being very engaged politically. Like, I have a brother who doesn't care for social justice or anything Asian concerning that.
He's lost in his own world.
No, it's not even just that. Like, he came to me talking about his sympathies to right-leaning parties and like,
does he spend a lot of time online?
Just I wouldn't even say was co-opting, but just absorbing this sort of sympathy and not realizing that white supremacy is like all around him. And it's kind of worse outside of America in a lot of ways, because we never had the same sort of movements onto like in the same scale anyway. And a lot, especially in Australia specifically, like the Asian population has only been in this country beside the Chinese, which have been here for like quite a while. But like the big explosive times was during like after Vietnam War, when they accepted refugees. So we don't have that same history, and we don't have the same consolidation of Asian Australian identity, the same as Asian American. It's still very like compartmentalized into different ethnicities, unfortunately. So we don't have that same identity, even though it's starting to
emerge.
Get the ball rolling on that, but it's still kind of
yeah,
not the same.
Well, I would say even when there was an Asian American identity, though, it was still very compartmentalized. But it was a coalitional identity. You see, like nobody really identified themselves as Asian American except in like a team banner sort of way. Everybody thought of themselves as like Chinese Americans, Korean Americans, you know, Indian Americans, all that, right? But then they created this term Asian American, you know, as a uniting force, like a defense pact, right? Mutual defense pact against white oppression and white racism and white supremacy.
Yeah, but it's kind of strange, because even if I identify myself as Asian Australian, it still seems like a very like unfamiliar term. I don't really hear that very much. Like, there's a lot of Asians in Australia, usually in particular spheres. Like, we all live on the East Coast, for example, but it's still kind of new. And also, because most of my interactions on this have been online, I've been like on the Reddits, in the Discords, and the problem is a lot of this talk isn't done in real life, and a lot of it, when it is talked about, it's just very, people are talking for the sake of talking, or
it's shallow.
Yeah, it's very shallow, like for concern, like, oh, this sounds bad, I feel bad, but no one's compelled to do anything or raise awareness.
Or
do the bare minimum, even.
Take direct action.
Yeah.
Direct action.
It's just, I don't know. I feel like it's a self-serving thing. Like, it's just so people can feel good about themselves. And because...
So as long as we're talking about Reddit, it's interesting to me. I'm actually banned from Reddit, just like I'm banned from Twitter. But around like 4 years ago, I stumbled onto our Asian American, right? And I was immediately banned by the head mod there, Chingla Shees. She's an Asian woman with a white man and very defensive about it. And I was banned for defending a gay Asian guy who said, like, sometimes, like, with all these, you know, the ones, like, the Asian feminists that call themselves that online, you know, he felt less solidarity with them than he does sometimes with, like, straight Asian guys. And then this other guy, Prophet Falls, came in and said, oh, you're a misogynist, blah, 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 all the usual jazz, you know. And I had just come onto this forum. I had never commented before, nothing, you know, like usually, I mean, I don't really use social media much, but, you know, for Reddit, it was mostly for reading news. And this was the first time I was in that forum, and I got banned like instantaneously for being like, yo, what the hell are you doing? You know, you can't just call someone a misogynist for bullshit reasons. And I got banned for that. So then I went over into our Asian masculinity, and like, that's all right. That in and of itself, it looked like every other Asian guy, like, space that's cropped up online, like, for the past, oh my gosh, I want to say since like the early 2000s. So every time you go to these spaces, they're like super, super reactionary, highly conservative, you know, right wing, bootstraps type bullshit ideology, which fundamentally disperses power. You know, and we can talk about that a little bit later, but, you know, there is no power without a collective. And they are fundamentally all about doing them themselves. So there's no sense of community. You know, people are over there posting some garbage, like how to be like this alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, eta, theta, iota, kappa, lambda, mu, nu, xi, omicron, pi, rho, sigma, tau, epsilon, phi, chi, psi, omega. I still have it. That's from my frat days. But like, but it's some bullshit, you know, like I'm reading this shit and it's like fucking horoscopes for men. It's like Cosmo for men, but even worse, because actually some articles in Cosmo might have some informative value, but there's nothing in there. It's just self-promotion, you know, like bragging.
That's a good analogy, Cosmo.
No, really.
How to be alpha alpha.
Yeah, it's like Sex in the City for guys, except none of them are getting laid, you know? So then like I come into this forum and I'm like, I start talking to these guys. And, you know, obviously, you know, I sympathize because I'm like, all right, I know why you guys feel all like messed up, you know, why you feel so down on yourselves, why you feel the need to posture, you know. So, and like the first thing I do is just to show them I'm a real person, you know, because I'm a big fan of that. You know, like I believe, you know, the internet is meant for communication and not just like anonymously and treating it like it's some game or something, but like a real conversation. So like I post pictures of myself. I'm like, this is me. You know, this is who I am. This is how I live. All right. Like, so you guys know I'm not bullshitting. I'm not like one of these keyboard warriors writing fucking field reports about their dates with women. Half the time, I don't even know whether to believe them or not, you know? And like, and I'm listening to them and they're just so lost, right? But they have all these like chips and chips on their shoulder and grudges. I understand how they feel, right? But, a lot of the time they're just like beyond saving. So like it took me like a year or so, you know, to try to basically quell like these MR Asians or whatever, you know. And I chased off a lot of them. The ones that stayed behind got reformed at least a little bit, because they were like, you know, I made it very, very unpopular to be like a Lyft bro. You know, and like I taught these guys, like, you know, like the history, at least in a, like a way they could understand, right? Like I kept it very, very basic, but like, you know, I wanted them to start to understand, you know, you don't have to wander life so lost, you know, like you're part of something, you're part of something bigger, you know. But like eventually what ends up happening is as soon as I leave, it all just sort of slides back, you know. And like people people really just can't take that leap from like collective identity to group action. For them, it's just an intellectual exercise. It's not something that they truly feel or that they mean. And like, I don't know if it's because they've been deprived of like social experiences or personal experiences or whatever, but I generally find they have no idea how to translate their knowledge, you know, what they gain from these spaces or from even learning history and facts and like applying it in the real world to bring about action. I posted this article the other day in the Pro-Asian Voice Discord, and it was about France, you know, and like how very recently, I can't remember, was it 2014? For the first time, you know, employees got a jail sentence for boss snapping. Okay. And I don't know if you guys, I don't know if our listeners know what boss snapping is, but it's a standard practice in France. All right. They've done it to like the CEOs, like the local CEOs of Sony and 3M and Caterpillar. These are giant conglomerates. All right. But in France, one of the standard negotiating tactics during a labor strike is to actually kidnap the boss. Okay. Because the labor there is militant. All right. And this is a widely accepted social practice. Like they've done public polling, right? And the public is in favor. The public is in favor of kidnapping your boss as a negotiating tactic during labor strikes. In 2014, I think it was 2014, there was the employees of I think it was Goodyear, the tire company. And even when they got a jail sentence, it was 9 months. And that was considered something like epic. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they even gave them 9 months in jail for kidnapping the boss in order to force changes at the company. You see, in company practice, that is direct action, right? And like in China, they do the same thing. They have the same practice. couple days ago, you know, you saw another example of direct action. You saw, I think it was anti-fascists. They like showed up. There was an angry crowd that showed up outside of Tucker Carlson's house. And they were just protesting him at his house.
Oh, I heard about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was
Tucker Carlson. He's like this racist white dude on Fox News, you know.
Yeah, I had like a hot minute where I was viewing American news, so I saw him quite a bit.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. Oh no, but I heard it from my brother and he was like feeling sorry for him. And I'm just like, oh, fucking hell.
Like, no, he made his bed.
Yeah, that's why it's called civil disobedience. So like, mm-hmm. That's the problem, right? Like you have a group identity and that's like, that starts to become a hub of power, right? Because, and maybe we can talk a little bit about this, Jay, because, you know, we were talking about this earlier on the nature of power. So, you know, like the traditional concept of power says that it comes from control of resources, right? You control the resources and therefore you have the ability to influence others, right? And through that, you create a social regime or a social order, right? A social economic order, a society. And they're fundamentally placing the locus of power in the control of resources. Okay, it's a very Marxist type of view too. But actually this is incorrect. You know, this is actually an incorrect conception, because the thing is, this is a reproduction of power. So they are looking at the people that are in power now, right? That are in power currently, and they see how they control all the resources and how they have the ability to say, you know, this is good, this is bad, right? Like how Nietzsche says in the genealogy of morals, right? Like all the kings and like the aristocrats and the noblemen, right? The heroes, they're the ones that are able to say, you know, this is virtuous or this is immoral, and it's by virtue of the fact of their power, right? Their control. But that's actually, if you look at the concept itself, it's flawed. Right? Because if power...
It's incomplete.
Yeah. If the origin of power begins in control of resources, right? Think about a situation where you are the only human alive on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine there was a nuclear war or like a meteor hit the earth or climate change, right? Just evaporated everybody and you're the only one left and you have control over all of Earth's natural resources. Do you have power?
Obviously, right? No.
Right? Because power naturally implies power over people, right? It's embedded into the concept. The idea of power is actually innately, you know, baked into it is this idea of a polis or a people, right, that are granting you that power. So actually nowadays in social psychology, they follow what's called a three process model of power. And the origin of power is actually not the individual or control over resources. It actually begins with the group. It begins with the group imagination. You see, the collective psychological imagination of a group of people, you know, and that's what is the basis of a social identity, right? A social identity like Asian American or Asian diaspora. And from there, you people, right, create a set of norms, you know, governance of behavior, ways of looking at the world, right, a culture. And then from there, you arises like these heroes. But, you know, what is a hero? You know, a heroic figure is someone imbued with power, right? It's the group is imbuing certain champions or avatars or representatives with power. I mean, if you can see this empirically in the real world, right? This theory, you know, when you have a presidential election in the United States.
Yeah, the voting process.
Exactly. So, you know, a couple million, 100 million people or so, you know, show up on a certain, on a, in a given time period, right? They take a little number two pencil and mark a little circle, right, on a piece of paper, and they all collectively turn in that piece of paper into a box, into the ballot box, right? And out of that grows power. It manifests within an individual, you know, whoever is elected president, it manifests with him. Like suddenly he now has superpowers, right? He can like, he can move like 5,000 tanks all over the world. He can bridge, swoop in like 10,000 predator drones, right? He can launch 4,000 nuclear warheads and reduce the entire planet to a barren wasteland. Like those are superpowers, right? And those arise, those manifest out of collective action. That's always the beginning. It's the seed, you know? Group identity is the seed of power. And the way that they destroy power, they introduce competition. You know, that's why neoliberalism is such a dangerous ideology, especially for minority groups. It's why it gets peddled so much, you know, by the Ford Foundation, by their front organizations like 18 Million Rising, Angry Asian Man, Mark Seng Putterman, all these types, all these Asian Americans Advancing Justice, all these nonprofits. You know, they're sold out. All their foundations, all their nonprofits are funded by these giant institutions, these other NGOs, right, that use them to socially engineer or shape a movement and drive it towards less of a group identity and purely into personal politics. You feel me? Whatever is good for me personally is what's good for everybody.
And that ties into what we were talking about in previous pods with the whole rise of the whole feel good politics, feel good feminism.
Yeah, hippie bullshit.
Yeah, self-help stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's all about the individual.
Exactly.
And it has nothing to do with the collective.
Because you saw, you know.
So it's just like, yeah, it's an illusion of power.
Yeah, personal power is meaningless.
Well, it's mostly like forcing people to take personal responsibility for the shit and the racism that happens
victim
to them.
Blaming.
It's so stupid.
Yeah, and then people internalize that, right? And they usually do so by the age of 3, all right? White people internalize white superiority by the age of 3, according to child development psychologists that have given talks at the UN, by the age of 3.
Mm-hmm.
And oppressed minorities internalize their oppression. They internalize their victimhood. So they believe that, you know, like they are the cause of all the suffering that is placed on them.
Which is fucked up, but also convenient for continuing to maintain the white power structure.
Can you imagine what that does to you psychologically? And you don't have to imagine. They've studied it at like UCLA. They've studied it. It causes mental illness. And that's why I laugh. I laugh, because otherwise I would cry anytime I see articles about mental illness in the Asian American community. And then they like talk about, oh, Asian Americans all suppress, you know, their Oriental culture.
Oh, God.
Can't handle mental illness, you know.
They fucking racialize it, right? When the cause is,
they blame it, yeah, on their parents.
Is racism.
The cause, yeah, is you guys. What is this like shifting of blame?
It's like when they started pushing like the tiger parenting stereotypes.
Thanks, Amy Chua.
They use that and utilize that to blame our culture, as if that had anything to,
exactly,
do with it.
Exactly. You know, I mean, you know, all across Asia after the global financial crisis, you know, you had IMF suicides, you had IMF riots. Those were, people were killing themselves because of the horrible conditions wrought by hypercapitalism and neoliberalism. And like, that's the ideology they peddle into all these spaces. And you can always tell, you know, they're always the ones asking for money, you know, or they're like trying to grift you by selling you some tchotchke or like some bullshit snake oil remedy for your problems. You know, some like penis pumps, not even kidding. There's a half Asian pickup artist called Good Looking Loser who sells penis pumps to Asian guys.
No. So that's real. Okay.
Like, this is how toxic it's become, you know?
How fucking exploitative to do that to your own people.
Right. So think about if you're like a regular Asian guy, you know, like you've never really fucked with online spaces or all that kind of stuff, you know, but like as you've gone through your life, you've noticed certain things, you've had certain experiences. And so, you know, you start to question. And so you go online and you start to look, you know, for answers, right? You type in Asian American or maybe Asian American guy or any of these keywords, and you get shuttled into these like spaces. So either you're going into these like neoliberal, neoconservative spaces like our Asian American. That mod, Cricket Monster, he's a traitor. You know, he's a chinilpa. Like, this dude is going around like defending the US actions in South Korea that led to the genocide of 100,000 Koreans.
Holy okay. crap.
Yeah, including the Jeju Island uprising. And he was actually defending that. He was defending that. He was defending the fake elections that got held that put Syngman Rhee into power. He was defending the installation of right-wing Imperial Japanese collaborators into the government structure by the U.S. You know, he didn't even realize Pyongyang only declared itself North Korea after the fake election of May 1948. Right? That election was fake. The franchise, the votes only extended to sympathizers, the right-wing police, right? The terrorist gangs, you know, all the collaborators.
The fascists.
Yeah. The Imperial Japanese collaborators, the property, the landowning class, you know, and all the village council elders that had been bought out. And Syngman Rhee won 92% of the vote in this fake fucking election that only extended to those and not to any of the people, you know, that were engaging in a struggle for their life and for their sovereignty. The U.S. was like telling, you know, the U.S. MGIK, U.S. command was saying, we need to get rid of all these overly patriotic Koreans. You know, so they installed all the Imperial Japanese collaborators back into power.
And it's like, how can somebody who has an understanding of how white power operates, how imperialism has destroyed so much of Asia and of the world, and can still defend those actions? Is it really a lack of understanding, or is it because they are so indoctrinated?
Well, he graduated from Columbia.
Yeah, okay, well, so that says indoctrination, basically.
Right. Like Jennifer Lee, right? All these types from the Ivy Leagues. They get indoctrinated into this like neoliberal, neoconservative way of thinking. So you're an Asian guy, and in that paradigm, there's no place for you. You know, if you're a heterosexual Asian guy, there's no place for you there because the US is at war with Asia. You know, ever since 1898, it declared war against China via the Philippines. You know, it wanted to conquer the Philippines just to attack China, literally for no reason. Literally for no reason other than racism. They just thought they were superior and therefore deserved all the resources. And they conquered South Korea for the exact same reason. They refused to decolonize South Korea because they wanted to take it over because they felt they were superior. They were the superior race. And they wanted to attack China. You know, Rudyard Kipling actually wrote the poem White Man's Burden, and it was about the Spanish-American War and the need to annex the Philippines. You know, mm-hmm. to bring Asians to civilization.
To civilize us savages.
Right. You know, it's so ridiculous. And that Asian Americans, you know, all mainstream Asian Americans are putting on this like sham, you know, show of patriotism that's just like jingoistic and imperialistic and neoconservative and refuses to grapple with like real history. You know, that's how you know they're sold out. And like, since they're at war with you, they don't want to see you. You know, you're the Asian guy. You're the guy that like actually fought them to a standstill and then kicked them out of Indochina, right? Along with the women, right? So they have animosity towards you. They still want to conquer China again for no reason other than racism. You know? Mm-hmm. It's funny that the US calls China an adversary. Who made them that? That was on you guys. They didn't attack you. You attacked them. And you attacked all of Asia for no reason, just to get to them, because you just thought you could.
I remember recently, and I think we mentioned this in a previous pod, that Trump was quoted as verbatim saying that China is a threat to American power. So that's as transparent as you can get about Western motivations regarding this and the relationship with Asia.
The director of the FBI is a Trump appointee. You know, I see all these white liberals like celebrating the FBI now because of, you know, the Mueller investigation. But the director of the FBI, his name Christopher Wray, he is an anti-Chinese racist. He is an anti-Asian racist, just like Pete Navarro. You know, he stuffed his whole cabinet with these anti-Asian hawks. And this dude is saying that all Chinese, it's an all of society threat to the US. Did you just declare fucking war on me?
Yep.
Did the FBI just declare fucking war on me?
And then saying it requires a whole of society response from America.
Vigilante violence. That's what they mean.
Weaponizing the power of the collective to do their dirty work.
Exactly. That's what all these, like, you think this stochastic terrorism, get the hell out of here. It's not stochastic if it's predictable. This is a predictable wave of right-wing white supremacist terrorism. All these shootings, these mass shootings, they cover it up, they obscure it. You know, I was telling you guys, ever since the Ferguson protests, four of those activists have died, and two of them were executed, right? They put two bullets in the back of their skulls and set the cars on fire, and the fourth one was lynched.
And then the cops have the fucking nerve to call it suicide. Okay, you were shot in the back of the head by yourself and then set your car on fire and then hung yourself. Okay,
and then you have
cool.
People going around calling themselves, you know, saying Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter. You only say this for clout. You only say this to virtue signal. You have no idea what it means to actually be on the ground for Black lives, okay? Like, this country hates Black people. White society hates Black people, all right? They hate us too, right? They hate us, but they hate us in a far away kind of way because they're waging war against us through their military and through like economic measures, you see? But for Black people, they have to live next to them, you know, in their entirety, right? All the ones they kidnap from Africa. So there's a special kind of hatred, a special kind of animosity towards them. And like, it gets covered up in all this like virtue signaling bullshit, you know? You can't trust a lot of Black mainstream figures either. Don't get fooled, all right? Don't get fooled. they all go through the same shit we do too. So they get co-opted too. You know, foundations take over their nonprofits, right? Black Lives Matter got co-opted by George Soros, also an anti-Asian racist, with yellow fever, who crashed all the economies of Asia. You know, I want to start cursing in Korean, you know, when I think about that shit, especially what happened to South Korea. But like, well, what is the alternative? All right, so then you have to go in there and suck Soros's dick. You're going to be like, oh, yeah, all this, like, you know, this NGO type activism, this 18 million rising. Yeah, rah, 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 cheer them on. Cheer on the celebrities, right? All the minstrels, all the fucking entertainers, you know, they're all sold out too, you know, all these guys. The whole structure, the system is set up to make them sell out. So you cannot trust them, you know? They are Chinilpa too. They are collaborators. And all you have left then is just a bunch of like fucking PUAs and red pillars hawking their social dominance theories, their bullshit, you know? And it's so sad because like red pill is an ideology fed to young white men, young white emasculated men that have been left behind by neoliberalism to keep them from ever having power. They don't understand. They think it's an assertion of their power, but it's not. It is actually them accepting willingly the chains that their masters have put on them. And in return, they get to vent against minorities. You see? They don't understand how, and women, especially women and minorities. Like, that's how their elite fuck them in the head. You know, they teach them bootstraps. They teach them, hey, assimilate. You know, think as you like, but do as others, right? Mm-hmm. Literally telling them to be sheep. Literally telling them that you have to obey and become a herd, right? To be used and abused and cut up, you know, for meat. And then they accept this bribe, right? The bribe of like racial prejudice in return. I mean, it's not like the leaders themselves aren't racist too. Trust me, they're all racist too. But like, you know, they also use that racism as a tool of division. And white people get sucked into it because they grow up into that culture where their social identity is constantly, it's a very fragile identity, you know, whiteness. It's a very fragile because there's nothing to it. It's just a repudiation of everything else. You know what I mean?
Yeah, which brings us to how awful it is for Asian men who are so marginalized and so vulnerable that they're easily taken in by these same red pill ideologies.
You're swallowing an ideology that they're feeding to their poor, and now increasingly everyone is poor, right? The middle class has shrunk to like what they call the top like 10%. If you define the middle class by what it usually means, you know, you have some property, you have your own land, you know, a house, right? Automobile, like kids, all that kind of stuff. You can afford to have kids, like all that kind of stuff. That's only like the top 10% of Americans, you know, and have some savings for retirement, you know, and everyone else is poor. So all these poor white guys, you know, the girls won't even fuck them, really. White girls won't fuck them. Minority women will fuck them, you know, but they don't like that, even though they like it, right? But at the same time, they self-loathe because they feel like they've been taught their whole lives that white is best, right? White is right. And they can't get Becky to touch their pee-pee because they're just not balling enough, you know? And like, and rather than come together and fight that, they would rather swallow that bribe of, okay, well, at least I can feel superior to minorities, you know, at least I can feel superior to colored people, and I can get to vicariously, you know, inflict the suffering that I'm feeling onto them, you know, whether through the military, right, whether through like venting racism, you know, through killings, through police killings, vigilante shootings, you know, mass murders, lynchings, all that kind of stuff. So it's really terrible when Asian guys internalize that, because you're, first of all, you're not even white, so you don't even get the bribe. All right. There's no like real, at least not any good looking or decent white girl waiting at the end of that rainbow for you. You know, if you want that, you are going to have to subjugate yourself, you know, and they're only going to take a few of you. They're not. And then it induces hyper competition, you see. And competition, I don't know if you guys saw that NSA slide, right, about the fracture points of what drives a group apart. One of the forces is competition. They know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. They want you to compete with your fellow man over the scarcity of resources, right? The one slice of pizza they left in the box.
Yeah.
And not focus on the 9 slices that are missing. You know, wait, what happened to those slices?
So you don't ever question what has been denied you, and yeah.
Because you're kept so starving. You're so starving, all right? So like that emasculation does that to you, and they make a buck off you, you see? Then they sell you some fucking pickup artistry after they emasculated you so they can rob your wallet, not just your manhood. What the fuck is this bullshit?
And then turn around and say, if it doesn't work for you, it's your fault.
Exactly, right? No, I mean, America is full of scams. You know, that's what happens when you take everything into the private sphere and, you know, and you spread around this ideology that's completely devoid of duty, you know, obligation, right? Moral duty, social responsibility. And that's also part of the reason why these like Asian spaces tend to not go anywhere, you know, because they don't find any sense of like morality or duty, which is what drives action. You know, like in their profile of Chiune Sugihara, you know, he was the Japanese official that issued like 6,000 visas to Jewish refugees, right, in defiance of Imperial Japan during World War II. And when they were profiling him, they found, and this is a finding that they find repeated over and over again throughout history, you know, he didn't think it was a big deal. He thought it was just not, it wasn't that it wasn't a big deal, because he did go home to his wife and they talked about it, you know, what would happen if he defied orders. But he was like, okay, but anybody else in my situation would have done the same thing, because I just, you know, how could you not, right? I had no choice. And that's an interesting perspective, because in one way, Zimbardo, you know, of the prison experiments, you know, he refers to this as like the heroic imagination. You know, it's that ability to envision, you know, a different way of thinking or a different way of acting from like everybody else. But at the same time, while you are free to think differently and act differently, right? You're no sheep. You're also acting differently, but you also are compelled by a strong sense of moral duty. That's the basis of heroism, is that they feel that sense of moral obligation, that communal relation. You know, like we have a group identity, right? We have a social identity that's the source of our power. But then also there's that desire to advance that community, to promote that community, you know, to fight off those that would harm and destroy the community. But it gets hard because the competition ideology that's been spread around is fundamentally premised on a very different spectrum of morality. So if you think about morality, right, and it, like forget all the checklists or like the content, just focus on the body, okay? So if you're just focusing on the forms that morality takes, there's 3 major forms, okay? The first form, what we were talking about here, duty, is what Shelley Kagan calls extremist morality, all right? Extreme morality. And it boils down to this one simple idea, okay? In any given situation, you should take the action that you can reasonably expect to have the best possible results, all right? In any situation, you should take the action that you can reasonably expect to have the best possible results. Now, nobody actually lives up to this, okay, in their everyday life. Nobody like examines every little action they take and then considers the opportunity cost basically of like, what is the better action, right? But embedded into that idea of morality on one end of that spectrum is the sense of duty. It's the sense of obligation. You are not living a private life. You are living a public life, you see? And then you can have like constraints on it, like, okay, I might have a special obligation to my family. So in the case of my family, I might not, you know, always be doing something that's better, right? But there's that you begin from the ground of, I am here to promote the greater good, okay? I am here to do the right thing. That is the price I pay for living. That's heroic morality. That's duty. In the middle is what you call ordinary morality, and it's fundamentally different, all right? In the ordinary morality, being moral, right? Taking actions to promote the greatest good is considered optional, okay? You have options. You do not have a duty, because if something is a duty, you do not have an option. You are obliged to fulfill that duty. But in ordinary morality, there is no such thing as duty. You might have constraints, like thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not rob, or you might have like special obligations. You know, if I see a child drowning, I should save them. But what's missing from ordinary morality is a sense of self-sacrifice. I am not going to sacrifice my private interests to promote the public interest, okay? That is what's called common sense morality and is actually fundamentally indefensible. There's no way to defend this, okay? And then on the very extreme end, you have people that say, I have no requirements, I have no constraints, you know, there's nothing that exists besides me and my own private personal aggrandizement, right? Nihilists. And like within that spectrum, you need to move people along to that highest level where they feel a sense of moral obligation to the Asian American community. But you see, people get stuck because fundamentally they've been taught this ordinary form of morality, right, which does not require or which does not recognize an obligation to do the greater good, right, as a purpose for living. They have no purpose, right, other than pure hedonism, other than pleasure, right? They have no purpose. If you have people at that stage leading, or if they're even worse, if they're like nihilists and they believe in nothing except self-promotion, then the community eventually dissolves because nobody feels a sense of duty. Nobody feels a sense of responsibility or obligation to one another. I don't owe you anything. What have you ever done for me? Like that kind of bullshit, you know? And then eventually the community dissolves and all that power evaporates, you see? And you no longer...
Which goes back to how to destabilize the collective. You make everybody compete with each other and become...
Crabs in a bucket.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What have you done for me? Look what I have done for you in my personal career that has not helped you at all. Yeah.
The thing is, like, I can definitely see a lot of this in real life. Like I told you, my mom, my brother, sympathizing with white racists and stuff. And it's, and like the time I've been online, like people have the ordinary morality most of the time. There's no collective like responsibility to do anything
exactly
for anyone.
Yeah.
And
me, it's all about me.
And it's not even, like I said, it was just faux compassion, but there's no real empathy. Like they see the news, they see like even like just pointing out everyday injustices, which would at least should at least elicit some kind of emotional response as human beings, as right. Asians, they just don't feel any responsibility or duty to do anything. And I feel like this is like, I don't understand. I've never been able to understand like how we got to this point other than, well, obviously white supremacy, but I think there just needs to be a shift.
Yeah. I would say the group imagination often gets corrupted, usually early on, and oftentimes, you know, like minority groups get infiltrated all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Hoover infiltrated all the Chinese American communities, knocked on every door, all this bullshit. And basically, they introduce this hyper-individualistic, often neoliberal and neoconservative. So then you will have the very bizarre, grotesque phenomenon of Asians cheering on American imperialism against Asians. You know, yes. That's a very strange sight to behold. But then also on top of that, they introduce like this free market ideology. And by the way, I am a, you know, proponent of free markets in a managed type of way, right? Like in a regulated type of way. But like, and it also depends on the sector. But, you know, when you look at it, it just turns into everyone trying to make a quick buck. Oh, let me charge you for my podcast. Please donate to my Patreon. And I'm just talking in the small communities. In the larger community, you have people like Celeste Ng, you know, using this so-called harassment of her, right, as a way to promote her books or her films, you know. At least she's actually grifting, you know. Some of these other grifts are like really low level, petty type stuff. But like once the community is full of people like that, it just implodes, you know, and that's the whole purpose of it, right? You saw it. Like US intel agencies said that's what they do. They introduce that hyper competition and that type of ideology into these spaces, because then you can't think of any collective solutions to anything. You can't think of any taking any kind of direct action against anything, you know, whether that's CEOs. You know, a lot of Asian guys bitch about Hollywood, right? Well, Hollywood is not some amorphous like blob, all right? Hollywood is not just...
It's made of people.
Yeah, Hollywood is not this magical entity. Hollywood is made out of 6 corporations, all right? 6 major corporations. No lie, you can look this up. They're all within 15 minutes of each other, too. All their headquarters, you know? And never once have I heard about protesting. Like, let alone boss snapping. I don't even hear... You know, like, during Me Too and stuff like that, you saw, like, even little girls protesting. Like, their teachers took them out, you know, to teach them civic participation or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
But all these Asian guys... with all that anger and all that energy, right? How come it never gets directed at the source? You ever think about that? They say Hollywood, but they never really name names, namespaces, or places, right? They're just like, oh, Hollywood. It's just this magical entity that continuously emasculates us, you know? And they fail to see the people that are pulling the strings. Actual people, they have names and faces. You can find them in a Google search very quickly, you know? They don't even think of making demands. The only thing they think of doing is like, oh, which of these 6 corporations that control all the media, which of these should I give money to?
Oh, God.
Oh, that's something I've noticed with, like, again, siblings, friends and stuff. It's just because we operate under this framework of, you know,
capitalism.
White supremacy, white power structures, capitalism, yes. It's like I said, like when my brother was mentioning, you know, Tucker getting, you know, protested out of his house, like he was trying to...
You were sympathetic to Tucker.
Morality. No, but he was mentioning the door getting like, oh, his door like got broken into and like that's wrong.
So
and
his morality is private property is what you're saying.
It just didn't make sense. Like what I've noticed continuously is like we don't even really truly identify ourselves as Asian first at all. Like it's superficial. It's cosmetic. Like, of course, everyone can look in the mirror and see you're Asian.
Yeah.
Like, people will admit that they're Asian.
Not always. Like, some people are really far gone, but yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But let's say the majority obviously can see. It's just they don't understand that it's not just your appearance. It's just how society interacts with you and how you are. You're in opposition to white supremacy, so you're going to be oppressed. Regardless, and people don't understand that.
Which is why it's insane to, when there's a conflict between, you know, a representative of white power and an Asian person, to immediately go to defend the white person, not knowing any information.
Oh my God. Yeah,
like you see it all the time.
This is a learned
behavior. Yeah, who taught you to hate yourself and to cape for white people?
And like every time I tell people, why are you caping for white people? We're like, but I'm just being logical. And I'm like, but who's gonna, let's just put aside like logic, you fucking psychopath. But like, look at, like if everyone's gonna take the white person's side, like every single person, who's gonna take the Asian person's side? Like who's gonna defend us as a collective?
Yeah.
And it's not, I'm not to say we're gonna defend like pedophiles because they always take it to the extremes. Or like, we're not going to defend murderers, but we just have to like think about what we're doing. Like, just sit back and think about what you're doing, because
they suffer from context.
If you're
going to
take the white person's side all the time, like, who's going to defend us? That's
like,
just
like, why are we identifying with the white person more than the Asian person? That's the fundamental problem.
All right, so, you know, group imagination. So we're talking about Asian American spaces online earlier, right? And those are already, those already at least have some form of group imagination. But for the vast majority of Asians in Western diaspora, they don't see themselves as Asian, you know, other than, like you said, Sen, through a very cosmetic, superficial type of way, right?
But they Boba.
Understand what it means to be Asian. And so when they see a situation between an Asian person and like a non-Asian, or in any other type of situation, they've even done studies on this, right? Empathy studies. The accessibility of the Asian category is not there. You know, it's not salient for them. Their Asian identity is not what naturally bubbles up when they see another Asian person, okay? And they're also, the category of like white racism is so underdeveloped in them, right? Intentionally, that it also does not reach their consciousness when they see an incident of like white people being racist towards Asians. So first they look at it and they're like, in their mind, the way their mind is working, that person is not me. Okay. I have no connection to that person, right? That group category of Asian is subordinate. It's suppressed. It doesn't rise to the top. And then all the knowledge, right, of like history and like white racism and institutional oppression and cultural genocide, you know, none of that is salient to them. Okay. All they are seeing is the literal text. Now, this is interesting. This is known as context blindness. It is literally a blind spot. You are not able to hold in a certain domain, all right, in a certain space of something. You are not able to hold multiple ideas because things have been planted into your mind, all right? Ideologies have been planted into your mind to suppress your consciousness of being Asian. So now you don't feel anything when you look at Asians, you see? But you feel something when you look at white people. It's really messed up. A lot of it is highly driven by media too. You know, and we talk about it a lot, you know, in Asian spaces, media, the environment that you grow up in trains your empathetic response to things. So I don't know if you guys saw that like study I always post where it shows if you watch a lot of TV in Western countries, your self-esteem goes up if you're a white guy, if you're a little white boy. But for everyone else, women and minorities, it goes down.
Yeah. Which really speaks to how deeply ingrained it is.
It's brainworms.
Yeah.
They've implanted brainworms in you, you know? And I use that imagery for a reason, because it's like the more you watch it, you know, like the more mimetic white racism becomes, until you can't see anything. You can't transmit anything. You can't produce anything or reproduce anything that's not in their paradigm. Right, which is racist, and you are subordinate. Even your own thoughts get policed.
And it's like, it's automatic because you've been molded into this shape, so that the only thing that comes out is stuff that doesn't challenge that white supremacist, yeah, paradigm.
That's how you know when someone is not woke, okay? They cannot challenge white power, all right? Even if they superficially say, oh, you know, fuck white racism, you know, I hate white racism, right? Or Sarah Jung at New York Times is going around saying, I hate all white people. Yeah, whatever. You see their actions. They take no action, especially not to challenge or confront in any way that would require any form of self-sacrifice against white power, you know? And then think also about what happens when you try to talk about these things. Sen, I know you talked about this a lot too, right? Like when you talk to other Asians in Australia, right? They will then become like possessed. The brain worms in them are encountering you, like bringing up these ideas that have been suppressed, you know, like have been censored in your mind from growing up in that environment. And they will suddenly attack you and try to suppress you, even though they're Asian themselves. And even though they go through the same shit you do.
Because their emotional well-being is like dependent upon maintaining that status quo, which is really fucked up.
Internalized fragility. I don't know.
They're like being fragile on the behalf of white people. Like, how dare you criticize white people as a group? Not all white people.
I also sometimes wonder whether they've internalized or feel that they're white. You see? Because I see all these articles.
Oh my God.
It's possible.
I was in an enclave, right? They always talk about, I'm a banana. I'm basically white inside.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you proud of that?
Oh my God. This is like me. This is like unprompted too. So I didn't ask them about their identity. They just fucking come to me and be like, I'm white. And I'm like, oh my God. Or they do some other thing where you could be just doing something normal and they'd be like, wow, that's so Asian. And I'm like, what? Like, we're pretty fucked over here. I don't know.
No, I've heard all those. And, yeah. You know, like we have it over here too. Or there's too many Asians here. Wait.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
Oh God.
Yes.
There are too many Asians in the room. There's only like two of us.
Yeah.
What?
Or even on an enclave, they're like, why are there so many Asians living here? I'm like, do you even understand anything?
Yeah, right.
Like, about things.
They literally lobotomized you and they didn't even have to go into your brain. You know, it wasn't even like get out. They got you, right? They got you through like stimuli that they didn't even have to like physically invade you. And a lot of the times people willingly, so if you watch a lot of American media, you know, if you start to have like this type of celebrity worship, or you start to follow like, I don't know, like white bands or like white celebrities, white shows, you internalize more and more of it, you know, and then you start to develop this deep, deep inferiority complex that prevents you from ever thinking that you can stand up for yourself, that you can fight for something, that you can change the world. You know, you look at power and it just scares the shit out of you. And that's the funny thing. It's like all these red pillars or whatever, they're fundamentally, they're all beta as fuck because they just want to be beta number one. You know, they have no desire or ambition to become the alpha at all. They just want to accommodate themselves into as comfortable of a position as they can wheel themselves into. And like, they call that Asian activism, you know? And when I say that, I'm thinking about Arc'teryx. You know, like this is the head mod of Asian identity that we purged, you know? We purged this guy back in the day from our Asian masculinity. And he's always been this like highly secretive, anonymous, like he's apparently an Indian guy from the Red Pill. You know, he used to go around quoting Mussolini, better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep, which I always laugh and tell people that's something only a sheep would say. You know, clearly you don't know what it really feels like. So like, you know, like for him, it's all about, oh, we need to work sneakily. You know, we got to be shadowy.
Oh,
and he believes in all these anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. So he's like, we've got to be like the Jews. We got to control the world like the Jews do. And I'm like, okay, listen, you know, if you look at wealth distribution in the United States, Jewish people make up half of billionaires, right? And we all know there was a reason for that. But for us, our community has the same amount of millionaires, which is also inclusive of billionaires, as Black people. 8% of millionaires are Asian. 8% of millionaires are Black people in America. Half of all billionaires are Jewish. How can you compare us to Jewish people? Fundamentally, the context is different, but he believes in these anti-Semitic theories and he believes in model minority. So he thinks we're all rich. Like, this dude literally goes around preaching income inequality because he believes Americans, Asian Americans are rich. Asian Americans are not rich. The funny thing about, you know, average income and like model minority and privilege, you know, and I think this is, I want to end it like sort of around this topic, is just like the idea of model minority. And I want to get your guys' thoughts too. Is like, when you look at income and wealth in society, it does not follow a bell curve. Okay. It is not a normal distribution. That's important. Okay. Because if you understand statistics,
yeah, the bell curve,
average, yeah, is only meaningful if the underlying data is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But they actually invented a whole new field of distributions to study income, because when they studied it empirically, they found it was not normal, right? You had a little bit spread out, you know, almost like in a bell curve way, but then at the higher ends, all of the wealth is concentrated. All right. They call that like 80-20. I don't know if you guys have heard of this like 80-20 principle. It applied to wealth distribution in society. That's where it came from. 20% of people own 80% of the wealth, right? That's a form of a Parisian distribution. If you look at America and like all these Western capitalist societies, it's like that. All right. So it's meaningless. The very idea of an average wealth or an average income is absolutely meaningless. All that matters is who has the most concentrations of it. You see, I'll give you an example. If you think about a stadium full of people, right? And think about in that stadium, it's just normal people. You have all ranges of incomes or whatever, right? From like someone making nothing, he's dirt poor, he like snuck into the stadium. And then you might have like doctors and lawyers making like 200K a year, or like even like 500K a year or whatever, right? And then everyone in between, like construction workers, office workers, you know, tradespeople, professionals, all that, right? And then Bill Gates walks into that stadium. What do you think happens to the average income when Bill Gates walks into that stadium?
It spikes. Artificially.
But did that actually make any of the other people richer?
No. And it's the same shit going on with Asian Americans. There's like a few wealthy ones who are skewing the curve, and there's this assumption that we are all carried up in it when that's not true.
It's the same number as Black people. We have as many millionaires as Black people do. Do you think Black people are rich?
Of course, not coming in here and giving us money. I know.
But it's also very dangerous to accept that, because then, you know, it fundamentally alters your strategy. Because it's one thing to think, okay, I have control of resources, right? I'm rich, or the community is rich. We have all this money. Well, if you don't actually have a lot of money, then that strategy is not going to take you very far.
Yes.
Because you're talking about using money to buy influence, and you always have to spend a lot of money to buy influence. You know, a billion here, a billion there, then we're talking real money. We just don't have that kind of capital. You know, we are more like Black people. I think people need to really get this through their heads. And it's like, and that's always been true since 1954, or what is it, 1854, People versus Hall. We've always been closer to Black people in this country. But because all these people that came over here after 1965 came from very unique sets of circumstances based on US imperialism in their countries, right? It just changed the mindset, and they got gaslit, and they internalized all this propaganda. Like, Jay, I know you have your own beef with Arc'teryx, right? Because he's a misogynist too.
Because I didn't realize this for the longest time, because when I was on Reddit, he wasn't very active. So the atmosphere was a little more accepting of women as people.
Cultivates red pillars, because that's how he stays in power.
Yeah. Has anybody noticed how fucked up it is that he's basically, as a South Asian man, hiding his face, hiding his name, and using East and Southeast Asian men to do his dirty work, to be basically meat shields for this ideology that he's pushing, red pill ideology, indoctrinating them because they're vulnerable, weaponizing their struggles, trying to get them to punch down instead of punch up. How does nobody see this? How is it okay for this person to be in power and continue to exploit in this way? How has nobody noticed this? How has nobody taken action against this?
Well, you know, it's interesting, right? Because Asian identity is not just him. You know, some of the other moderators are from back in the day, and they got banned from Asian masculinity for a lot of it was personality conflicts with Dai Lo, who was sort of unstable. Actually very unstable. But you know, like when they're around, they built like an ideology based on like the work that we did in Asian masculinity, you know? And so there was still embedded in those ideas, like some of those ideas, some of those principles, you know, some of those moral precepts, which people that are in the know, that like understand stuff, they come to that forum and they'll get it, you know. And I've seen good posters come through that sub, you know, that's what gives me hope for it. But it's always hard when the leadership is so compromised, you know, and everywhere you look, it's always been that way. Even our Asian masculinity, you know, like the head mod, the creator, was from the Red Pill. His literal name was the Red Pill Submitter. But I don't think the spaces will truly ever get anywhere unless, you know, you have leadership, you know, people that not just have formal positions of authority, but also, you know, are able to convince others, are persuasive, you know, and then are also willing to like put their money where their mouth is, you know, and speak up in real life and confront people and institutions in real life and challenge power out of a sense of duty, you know, out of a sense of like obligation to the collective and to the community. You know, because whatever your private interests are, you know, like you also have to understand you weren't born into a vacuum. Like that's what they do to your brain to make you intentionally stupid. You have to be able to understand like the situation, the context of things, not just the literal text, the context and the subtext of things, you know, the hidden meanings, the implied things, the associations. And I really hope like, you know, like those spaces, like learn to recognize that shit, because otherwise it's always going to get overrun by these bootstraps, lift bro type motherfuckers who, oh my gosh, it's just so silly watching them squirm. I swear to God.
And I think this is a good time to bring up that the personal is political doesn't mean that bootstrapping is going to affect any political change, as some might believe.
Exactly.
It means taking the oppression that you face in the private sphere and making it public so that you can hold people accountable for it, so that something actually changes.
And you can regulate the behavior, right? You can apply institutional power to it, you know, whether through laws, whether through group norms, social codes, you know, company policies, practices, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of levers that you have, but first you have to develop that will as a community, you know, to free yourself from that oppression. And you have to understand that power is granted through the community. Like, getting little scraps of individual personal recognition and status is not real power, okay? You're still their bitch. You're still waiting on them hand and foot. You know, you're just in a little bit of a nicer, like, outfit. You have a nicer work uniform. I will say though, you know, like I do think the misogyny, it needs to be kept in check, because yeah, I get it. We get a lot of like misandry and it's all racist too. It's not genuine misandry. You know, it's just racism masquerading as feminism or misandry. And the reaction to that is naturally, obviously, you know, people clinging to right-wing ideology. But the thing is, it's all a trap. You know, don't get stuck into those like pitch battles. Both those camps are useless. Okay. Like they are way far gone. And the brainwashing has started early. So it's very unlikely you're really ever going to reach them. It's better to try to form communities where people are aligned and on the same page, okay? Because there's many ways to be anti-Asian, but actually very few legitimate ways to be pro-Asian.
I mean, we've been through these spaces before and tried to form co-ed collectives, and it's always fallen apart.
Yeah, it's always been... We have to accommodate because we're seen as outsiders, which makes sense because it's a very male-dominated space, Reddit is, but I just never felt like we belonged or anything we said mattered. And it has a lot to do with the fact that people don't take it too well being lectured at or being too PC, like,
or just like, especially women, like there's some leeway for men who say stuff that's seen as out of turn and shit, but a woman, and the reaction is just so much more intense and more vitriolic, because it's like, how dare you?
Yeah, I've seen dudes go, oh yeah, she deserved to get raped, and then people are just kind of like blasé about that. I'm like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, I was always that person going, stop, don't do that, don't say that, that's terrible. Like, on a moral standpoint, that's a terrible thing to say. Whereas, like, you say something a little bit out of line, you're like, aloo, automatically, and it's really annoying.
But this is just, like, this is the atmosphere in there. And this is why it's just so deeply ingrained. That's why it's so difficult to move beyond it, and that's why it's so difficult to heal the rifts in our community. And so I'm...
Because let me tell you, the problem is all, like, the Asian guys that would be more egalitarian, they get co-opted into like this whole 18 million rising framework, you know, into all those little bubble communities. So what you end up with are like the real fringe cases, people that either really, truly, deeply understand what's going on, which is usually leftists. I'm talking Asian leftists.
Yeah, you know, we're not talking Baizul, because those are rightist in ideology.
For sure. For sure. But like Asian communists, Asian socialists, you know, even, I don't know, I'm a social democrat or a social liberal myself, but like, you know, usually like left-leaning types. But then a lot of the times they can't stand it either, because like all the reactionary bullshit, all the MRA garbage, you know, like it's just really tough. And, you know, like you want to reach these people because unfortunately, the real world is much messier and dirtier than people give it credit for, okay? The real world, like what you see on YouTube, does not even, like even in comments, does not even scratch the surface of how like dark and nasty the world can get. So like, you can't go around thinking that people aren't carrying these kinds of ideas and beliefs in their head, because they are, you know? And a lot of them also pick shit up online, and there's no real space for true pro-Asian ideology, because half the time these people don't even know what the fuck being Asian means, you know, or what does it even mean to be white, or what does it mean to have power, like what is the nature of power.
And that's why I'm really thankful for Pro-Asian Voice. Like, I'm sure we all came into this really skeptical, right? Or at least yeah, I did, just because of our previous experiences. But I do feel that because that we're aligned ideology, like we might have disagreements about details, like, you know, the tone in which we deliver things or like the ways in which we interact with other people. But at the end of the day, there's this mutual respect because we have a similar understanding of what's at stake and what's really going on. And that creates trust.
Yeah. And how to approach it, right? Because if you're talking about real politics and you're not just talking electoral politics, not just voting in a booth, right? Politics is an all of society affair, right? The everyday life of a society is politics. It's political. It's about forming those group identities, those social identities, pursuing your interests, you know, in a collective type of way, trying to gain power, you know, and right wrongs, address injustice. And I think a lot of that is just, you know, for the first time, really being cultivated in a clear and coherent way in this space. You know, I give you girls a lot of credit too, because I've been at this for a while now, like over 4 years, you know, in online spaces, like not talking about like what I do in real life, and it's like the first time I've actually felt like there's a space where people are committed and understand what the hell is happening around them, you know. And I think since group imagination is this seed, is the origin of power, I think that bodes really well, you know, at least for the future, because if we can keep growing, if we can grow the consciousness, if you can actually get people woke and not sucked into all these dead ends and traps and pitfalls and like infiltration, then I really think that you'll see a new like age start for Asian Americans and Western Asian diaspora. You know, we should really try to think internationally, because all our fates are sort of linked in that way.
Foreign policy mirrors domestic, so decolonization has to be a global thing.
Because a lot of, I guess, thought of, you know, Asian diaspora does come from America, it's kind of very imperative that, like, I'm not saying that we should just sit around and do nothing, but it's very imperative that, like, Asian Americans try and take the mantle. Like, they don't understand, like, the power they hold, you know, in our communities. And also, I think that every time that we've tried to start something, it's like trying to light a match in the rain and having no, like, you know, flint or anything.
Yeah.
And it Tinder. Never really, you know, yeah, having nothing and trying to make a fire, it just never works. But I think that this time, I'm not even going to say it might work. I'm just going to say it will work.
Oh, at least plant seeds.
Okay. Like, this is the most optimistic I've ever seen you, by the way. Sen is like...
I'm like the most pessimistic person.
So cynical.
Especially going into this, I wasn't really sure, because I'm always skeptical. Because every time like we've done something, it never worked out. And it's not because people are inherently malicious all the time, because we have met some good people. It's just because... people can't see any future or any potential.
That's
it
right.
Just becomes like this. Everyone becomes depressed and then they just leave.
They get burned out.
For a majority of people.
Like all the good people get burned out and leave, and we lose them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we almost got burnt out last year. Like we were pretty done. We've only been on this thing for like a year or two, like before. So we were just kind of done. And I just can't believe that it took so long for opportunity as well.
Yeah.
Because we all kind of collided at the same point in time.
Always predict. You know, I guess one last thought from me, you know, like I think the best metaphysical book I've ever read, you know, and it's about it's by a physicist called Purbach, and the title is How Nature Works. But he was talking about earthquakes, you know, and like how different earthquakes, like the magnitudes of earthquakes, like the Richter scale is a whole order different. Like a magnitude 3 versus a magnitude 4 is not just a linear progression. It is truly like exponentially different and larger. But Purbach was saying, you know, when we study earthquakes, what we realize is that there's no difference in the way a magnitude 3 and a magnitude 9 earthquake starts. They both start out the exact same way. But what ends up happening is for the magnitude 9, it just doesn't stop. You know, it just doesn't stop. There's just things that have been embedded and built in over time that allows it to continue, you know? So you should always try to keep some hope alive, because every movement that comes, whether or not it achieves its stated objectives or goals or outcomes, also plants the fuse for any future explosions, you see?
I think that's a good note to end on. I hope that...
Great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And if you want to contact us at ProAsian Voice, proasianvoice.com, we do have a contact feature. Al is not on social media, so if you wanted to reach him, he would be there. I'm on Twitter, as you all probably know, at J_MARAAN, and Sen.
Oh yeah, I'm Sen, SEN_TINT.
So yeah.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much.
And thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you next time.